Honestly, I've seen listing just, you know, an autopilot business for you, you know, 1K a month recurring revenue. Again, autopilot could be ran for like 5 years, no need to touch it. Defensible business model, strong model. Like, as an example, right? If that turns out to be true and that's the starter of the listing, man, competition and bidding for that is going to be crazy. And back to the strategic acquisitions front, yes, strategic pays better, but finding a strategic buyer may or may not happen. It may not be the right time, they may not be looking or anything. You know, it can take 12, 18, 24 months to find a strategic buyer versus a traditional financial deal closing in 3 to 6 months.
Hey there, Kristen Jacobson here. So here's a fun but sad fact for us. Most of the people that love our show are still not subscribed to our channel. Now, here is the deal that I'm going to make with you. If you can find it in your heart to click the subscribe button, I promise you that we're going to get better guests to provide more deeper insights and more practical steps in the online business M&A space. So that's the deal. If you can hit the subscribe button and also put on the notifications, we'd be really, really grateful for that. And we'll make a better show for you moving forward. Now, I hope you enjoy the rest of the episode. All right, Mario, welcome to the Digital Dealmakers podcast, my friend.
Hey, gents. Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Awesome, man. Well, let's kick things off. So Mario is a pretty well-seasoned site acquirer, and he's doing a lot of interesting things in the space. So, you know, hopefully we're going to get a lot of value in hearing from his perspective on, you know, what he really looks for in terms of acquiring a site and just some of the things that he's seen over the period that he's been doing this. And yeah, really, really appreciate you jumping on, man.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been around for, 14 years on Flipper Show. So I've seen things go up and down at the same time. Different sorts of deals, different transactions, small and large sites, marketplaces, publisher websites, commerce, Amazon, agencies, newsletters even. So it's been quite an interesting journey, at least in my perspective. So I'm more than happy to share more about that.
I'm going to say 14 years. That would have been like where you first started getting started when there was dial-up internet almost.
When I was first getting started, just for context, we were still going to computer clubs to get, you know, public internet access, and there was the dial-up modems, and we were like printing and saving things on floppy disks so that we can then print them and read them at home, or like even going to a Xerox and copying over books together to cut the cost from a print per page cost. And you know, it's been a significant journey. So 14 years is the more recent age, at least in my book.
We always say that every year in this space is like a dog year. So you've been doing it for more than 70 years. But yeah, Dom, let's kick things off. And I know you've got a couple of questions around, you know, what from a buyer's perspective, but also some value for like the seller perspective. If someone is listening or watching this podcast that is looking to potentially, you know, sell a content site, what things to really consider and get a buyer's perspective on it?
Yeah, exactly. So I think for a bit of context, I met Mario in person probably 2 or 3 weeks ago now, but obviously heard a lot about him over the last 6 months, or pretty much when I started at Flipper, as a very active buyer and active entrepreneur. So, you know, who better to kind of bring on someone who is very experienced in the acquisition field in smaller businesses, but also larger businesses. So I think it's really helpful for the sellers in our audience to really ask themselves throughout this episode some questions and have those answered. So Mario, I met you a couple of weeks ago in person in Sofia in Bulgaria, and obviously I've heard a lot about you over the last 6 months, 12 months working at Flipper, because you've definitely been someone who's heavily involved in the online business community and certainly a serial acquirer, right from smaller businesses through to larger businesses. And I thought it would be fantastic to have you on the podcast, because I can imagine as a seller, you're very much interested in knowing, okay, what do these buyers want and what are these buyers looking for? And give your point of view of the types of businesses that you've acquired in the past. I believe it's 40, which is incredible. So yeah, please tell us about that journey, that 14-year journey.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll probably start a little earlier, but I built my first website back when I was probably 9 years old. I was lucky to have a computer and endless spare time during summer vacations and all that. So I was spending 16 hours a day just lurking around and trying to build something, breaking windows and all that jazz. So that led me to some very early career opportunities in my teen days, working at IT cafes, media networks, translating resources, including security news, managing forums and online sites and so forth. So I'd say I had a very early exposure to different types of businesses and media networks and publishers, working with journalists, with very smart, creative product managers. And this was very inspirational. Not everyone has had that exposure. I fully realize that. So I'm trying to educate and share a lot of resources myself to just kind of give back the favor in a sense. So at some point, I was working as a software engineer. I spent several years in kind of enterprise software engineering, building lots of different things. And I switched to full-time freelancing in 2007, 2008, then founded my first business, I think, 2010. And throughout that kind of journey, I was aware of what a business looks like, what it represents, you know, how to launch a different kind of business models or so. But this kind of provided very, very specific insight for me as to what I could deliver. But at the same time, I wasn't necessarily able to get there by myself, meaning that starting from zero to the first customer, to the 10th customer, the 15th customer, was something that was extremely complicated, required a lot of outreach, finding the right funnel, finding the right community, whatever it is.
And time as well. I can imagine time is a resource, so it probably also costs a lot of time. Yeah.
Most definitely. And also builders, like engineers or even marketers and managers and people who are in an opportunity that they're able to build something or purchase something or pay someone to build something, it doesn't mean they can necessarily scale it, or they may not have access to that very right audience. So that's kind of how I stumbled upon Flippa. I found some starter websites to buy. They already had some users, some resources, some subscribers, and I found it much easier to get something going with an existing user base or subscriber base as compared to starting from scratch and just begging for my first user, second, fifth, 10th user. I think this was kind of the breaking moment. Then it kind of got sticky. I did set up alerts on the site or whatever the alerts version was over a decade ago, but I was tracking down specific search queries and like looking every week for, is there something interesting? Is there a publishing website we can take and acquire and grow further? Is there a starter site that we can launch or test as an offer? Is there an outsourced solution that we can buy and just kind of add as a complimentary service? And if it works, we would have outsourced resources to just test. And if it works for good, we can just kind of build it as an additional suite to whatever we offer. So that's kind of how we started. And yes, I do have over 40 acquisitions. Many of them are smaller kind of starter sites or so, but some of them are, I'd say, high five and six figure businesses that we've, you know, acquired internally and have also facilitated several deals in the low to mid six figures range myself with people around me, business partners, or people looking to acquire a similar business in that range.
Okay, so back on the ranges. So has your kind of investment philosophy or growth philosophy always been, you know, acquire a business, for example, random numbers, $10,000 or $15,000, apply a playbook, a formula, increase the revenues and obviously the profitability, and then that business is worth, let's say, $100,000, for example. Is that kind of the journey and playbook that you're exercising at the moment?
This is one of the playbooks, yes. There are several others as well. One of them is using an external resource and adding it as an additional feature to an existing set of solutions that we offer. Let's say we offer a marketing retainer that includes SEO and go-to-market strategy and whatever, right? And so we sell 20 of these on a monthly basis, but we can also acquire a tool that costs 10 grand. And we can generate reports through that tool and sell them at, you know, $500 each. So we can literally pay this off in the first month by selling 20 licenses or 20 reports, $500 each, and repay for that too immediately from month one. So this is kind of the strategic acquisition opportunity of kind of how we can get there.
Yeah.
In other cases, we can also do, let's say we buy a publishing website that's in a specific niche and we work with clients in that niche. So we manage to land kind of sponsored featured opportunities or guest posts or an interview or so, like a PR story in a sense. And we do that for 2 or 3 clients, charge them whatever, $1,000, $1,500 each. And then we pay back for, I know, a third of the acquisition or so, again, within the first 60 days, right? And then it kind of
becomes incredible. Okay, so you're also a, yeah, it sounds like, and I didn't know this really, a strategic acquirer as well. So, you know, with your agency business, you acquire tools or products, SaaS products, for example, which you can then acquire the product itself for an amount, and then you like to, you know, and it's obviously useful for your clients to better the experience and your effect and your impact for your clients. You can also then onsell that. Okay, that's really interesting. And do you ever look to those products? Do you have like in-house functions and capabilities within your agency or team which can maintain these products or SaaS businesses, or do you outsource that work?
Yeah. So as an agency, it's easier for us to maintain internally. In some cases, we do a mixed model. We either partner up with a business that's capable and is able to do that, or work with freelancers, consultants, contractors as needed. Or in some cases, with the acquisitions, we get access to people who have maintained the product. Meaning, in some cases, we speak to a seller and they're a business person, right? But they work with a developer on a freelance basis or on a contract basis, whatever it is, and say, hey, I'm going to share the contacts with the developer. You can keep working with them. They charge whatever hourly rate or so.
Okay.
Yeah, that's very interesting. On that point, when it comes to, say, it sounds like a few of these like acquisitions that you've made is sort of, you know, as you said, starter sites or something that's, you know, sort of just seeding. In terms of valuation, you know, because the standard is like EBITDA times a certain multiple, but I mean, do you have a different like viewpoint on valuing a business that like might be a really good fit that you can easily like just get an ROI on and would be, you know, sort of willing to pay above what the standard market rate is, or do you go in like and treat it the same way as a standard valuation? I'd like to get your perspective on that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I generally divide the types of acquisitions into categories, strategic and financial. When it comes to financial, it's more conservative. So yes, it is EBITDA by a certain multiplier for the category, depending on the times we live in and investment opportunities and how competitive the market is. This is kind of the traditional playbook for financial. When I take a look at an opportunity as a financial buyer, I know that they don't necessarily have a competitive edge, right? They don't have direct contacts or a network I can plug in that could directly, you know, skyrocket this and so forth. So it's just a good deal that I can pick up, and I expect this to keep going in the same pace for the next 18 months or so, and then, you know, reach a break even, and then we can think of any form of profitability. That's a very back of the napkin type of napkin as a financial investment. As a strategic investment, again, similarly to the previous considerations, in some cases we are just able to you know, bring and infuse additional resources or contacts or network or plant portfolio or so, which would justify having a product and making it worthwhile. One example for an acquisition, there was a kind of bubble product for, I think, $10,000 generating images and having kind of an AI image generator. So we had a couple of clients that just required image assets. So if we went with our designer, it would be like, let's say, generating 20 images costs whatever, $2,000 or $3,000 or whatever it is, right? With some back and forth and so on. And instead, we could use the two and generate 50 and let the client pick 20. And it's going to cost us like $5, $10. And we have a library to keep building on and so forth. So that's, again, a clear example of one single client, one opportunity. We speed up the process, we save internal resources, and we can actually make more money and keep doing that. You know, same goes for, we acquired a WordPress plugin for $18,000 or $20,000. It paid back in 14, and it was entirely on autopilot. It required probably 2 to 3 hours a week of support and some very light development combined. So it was pretty much an autopilot. Even if you don't have the resource, you can work with a freelancer, go on Codable or whatever it is. And it was just a passive income type of thing. It had SEO working. It had a freemium plugin on WordPress.org that was ranking well and getting free users. A portion of them were converting and so forth. So that's another example of that. So again, different situations. Some are more financial, some are more strategic, and we apply different playbooks depending on how quickly we believe we can get a return on investment. And we also always consider the build versus buy. Like, if we build it, how long would it take? How complex it is? How long would it take to reach that customer base if we were starting from scratch?
So in terms of, like, I mean, a lot of the sellers that I speak to that are believing that they could find a strategic acquirer, do you find, I mean, do you generally see that these people that are, you know, sort of would be a good strategic fit for you, do they already kind of know that they could be a strategic fit, or they don't really know, and then you know sort of like highlight that the reason for strategic acquisition? Like, how do you navigate that when, because a lot of the time sellers that are trying to, you know, sell on potential or a strategic acquisition usually really outprice themselves for a potential buyer. So, like, how do you navigate that? And, like, what do you generally see that might, some sellers might make, you know, mistakes around or misconceptions around in that sense?
Look, I know you guys are much more experienced in that compared to me, because you work with buyers and sellers, and both of them have completely unrealistic expectations, and you just need to bridge the gap and kind of...
We've got to bridge the gap, exactly. That's the challenge. Yeah.
So it's kind of common, and I understand that. So first off, also sell some properties, not too many, just a handful, but, you know, some of them were in the six figures, and I know how in some cases you invest seven figures and then you exit for six figures and it's not fun. Or, you know, you pour in, we have a product, we've spent over 4,000 development hours internally, so that's, you know, it's costing many, many, many tens of thousands, or like over $100,000 internally in just like sheer engineering effort, but we couldn't scale it properly. And in terms of a product, because it's generating almost no revenue, if you take a look at the pure EBITDA basis, it's probably going to cost $1,000, right? So what's realistic and how much effort you've put in?
Yeah, what's
reasonable? Don't really have a lot in common.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so both buyers and sellers should be aware of that consideration, but again, the truth is somewhere in between, right? So in that SaaS case that I mentioned that we spent a ton of time, it's not generating significant revenue, so it's not really a helpful cash cow, and we've invested a lot of time. So if you take a look from a purely financial standpoint, EBITDA wise, it probably costs $1,000 or $2,000, $3,000. However, if you want to build it, it's still going to cost you $30,000 or $40,000.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, like, a lot of sellers just, you know, what I've experienced in my time of helping sellers is that, you know, effectively I'm looking out for red flag keywords such as, like, this business has got plenty of potential, or I'm looking for a strategic buyer, which generally means EBITDA is not there, but they've built something. And, you know, and in some cases they have actually built something that has some value for the right type of buyer. But in most cases, it's just that they think that, you know, having 1,000 email subscribers for a particular niche, that they can somehow charge, like, you know, essentially like $10 a lead, when someone could easily just get a list of email subscribers for, like, you know, $2. So it doesn't even really make sense. But yeah, it's just interesting to see, like, from a strategic acquirer's perspective, like, you know, when you see a business that the seller may not even know that it could be a strategic acquisition for you, and how you sort of go about navigating, you know, without enticing them to, you know, to play hardball on the pricing side of things. So yeah, it's an interesting perspective that you brought there too, but it's always a balancing act, I guess.
I think one thing I want to say on deals I've been where I've tried to structure to make both sides happy is, the seller has a fantastic product. They've put a lot of sweat and tears and time and knowledge into something. Okay, they can't get it to where they need to in terms of monetization. We can create a win-win. So yeah, you're not going to exit for $1,000. I would never encourage a seller to do that. But there's certainly an opportunity where you can take some money off the table and keep some skin in the game with a buyer and leverage off their expertise, capital, network. And I can imagine, Mario, you've explored some deal structures like that before in your time.
Yeah, and that's a great reminder of going through experienced M&A advisors like you guys is really helpful because of structuring creative deals. Normally when, you know, let's say I want to buy a supermarket, well, supermarket's probably too large, but just a coffee shop nearby or so, just a local business, right? It's pretty simple. It's very hard to get creative and run different strategies of late payments or seller financing or like any other deals. Most of them are fairly straightforward, take it or leave it type of offers. And kind of what I've seen working with M&A advisors on Flip essentially is finding a lot different opportunities that are, let's say, hey, you know, we can pay you this much right now, but you have the opportunity to earn back however much in the next 12 or 24 months. If you stick around, we're like buying you, but we are also going to pay you a salary in the next however much to stick around and keep growing the business, and you take a portion of equity. It's almost like venture capital, but reverse. You know, in VC, normally someone, you know, gives you a lot of money, takes 10% of the business, but sits on your cap table forever and dilutes you and pushes you to do something. Here, it's more about, you know, someone is taking over the business and the opportunity, but you can also stick around and keep growing and have some almost like a sales commission structure afterwards. So I've seen a handful of these deals that are very interesting, especially in the financial acquisition space, wherever the buyer doesn't necessarily have the skills or the know-how or the network, and they need the seller to stick around for a while or even stick around forever. So these opportunities are very interesting. And back to the strategic acquisitions front, yes, strategic pays better, but finding a strategic buyer may or may not happen. Yeah. It may not be the right time, they may not be looking or anything. You know, it can take 12, 18, 24 months to find a strategic buyer versus a traditional financial deal closing in 3 to 6 months. And you probably have better numbers than I. But again, there's definitely a difference of whether you just want to sell and get rid of that, or maybe the business is in decline and you know it's going to get worse, so you just want to make sure you have everything packed and ready to go. Or, you know, keep it as a cash cow, stay afloat and improve some financial metrics to prepare for a strategic acquisition with very specific businesses, very specific expectations, prepare your deal room and set everything straight for the transaction.
Yeah, super good insight there, Mario. I mean, follow-up question to that, like, what are the common things that you see sellers making mistakes in terms of, like, you know, if you, let's say that you find a business that you'd like to acquire, you like it a lot, and you want to acquire, you know, want to make it happen. What are some of the common things that sellers do that sort of basically tank a deal, or like
make it, or maybe to even make it more kind of tangible? What was the last deal you walked away from, and why? Maybe, of course, don't divulge the information, the names. Yeah, but. What was the last deal that you signed an LOI for and walked away from, and why? Yeah.
So a couple of specific examples, and they're kind of in the same category or so. But first, when it comes to tanking a deal, I see three different categories of problems. The first one is outright lying. You know that the business is tanking, you're trying to hide something, and this is the worst possible thing you can do.
Yeah.
Again, you can probably get away in a small transaction by someone just paying money for nothing, but it's very unlikely it happens. And, you know, you also don't know what the consequences are going to be after, right? After all, you're sharing personal details, credentials, emails, and whatnot, so the person can actually, you know, sue you after, or, you know, do something crazy, right? So outright lying is obviously a no-no in my playbook. The second thing is missing something due to out of sheer understanding of how the ecosystem works. For instance, someone built something for you, but you don't really have access to the hosting, or they keep the intellectual property because you don't have your contact straight, or something like that. So this is a very painful one, because the seller is well-intentioned. It should be a good deal, but they actually cannot transfer everything that you need, or it turns out it's an unsellable deal, or it just requires insurmountable efforts to actually overcome that. So this is the second category. And the third one is simply making the transaction long and painful because you don't have everything set and ready for the transfer, which is essentially the deal rule. So these are kind of the three categories. And by everything in place, I mean access to domain names or, you know, hosting access to show. Like the best deals we have, they have a deal room, or at least they have even like a Google account that you gain access to, and then there's a Google Drive or a spreadsheet with all the passwords. Just everything set and forget. You receive the spreadsheet, you have all the links to all the tools, to billing, to hosting, to admin, to whatever it is, and that's it. It's simple and easy as that. So if you prepare yourself for that, it's a smooth transaction, and if people are on the fence, it makes it easier for them to actually acquire. In terms of transactions that I walked away from, they were in the second category. So both were publishers, and their SEO traffic was tanking. So they only had the last month of data, which was in decline, but it was January, so it was kind of on the fence, right? Q4 is a strong season, you get more traffic, January is slower, but it happens everywhere. Like, people are just not browsing around in January, still taking breaks, still on vacation, and so on. So it was kind of on the fence, even though I knew for both deals that this was the SEO algorithm, the helpful content update kicking in and causing some damage there. So I knew that, I was fine with that. This was something that we can improve internally, so it's totally fine. However, both publishers, one of them was in the life coaching space, just motivational speaking, you know, living a better life, better relationships, better communication, so forth. And it was a nice cash cow I would get in. I just like, you know, keeping people positive, giving them extra resource to, you know, decrease depression and things like that. So not something I'm going to do for a living, but a good side project to make me feel better and to also keep growing and have some writers write about. So this is one of them. The other one was something in the investment space, I think. So financial advice, tips, strategies, stock, and so forth. So both were good deals. Both were around 45,000, I think, asking price, making around $2,000, between 1,300 and 2,100 a month in reported profit from ads. And I knew that, you know, payback time, roughly speaking, 80 months or so. Again, roughly speaking. So both were good deals in my playbook that I would buy. However, during the due diligence, I realized that both businesses were using Mediavine for ad management. And Mediavine's official terms of service and their policy claims that even during a business acquisition, transferring the ad account is forbidden.
Yes.
And buyers have to set up their own account. However, the buying process has very high thresholds of ongoing traffic, trailing 12 months and different things. Plus, both of these accounts had slightly better terms due to accrued, you know, commissions and being kind of loyal buyers, and they had a better network that a new buyer setting up a new account is not going to be able to match. So in that case, the deal was actually unsellable unless the seller goes through the hoops of either making it happen with Mediavine support, like, hey, you know, we're just going to transfer the email account, so it's still kind of falling in line with the policy, or transitioning to a different ads provider and kind of retaining the terms that they have right now so that they make the transition possible. And again, this is something that may actually tank a deal. So you may have all the access in the world or all the systems, but it doesn't mean these are transferable and these are sellable. And if they're not, essentially you're selling a website that's generating zero revenue once picked up by a buyer.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, in saying that, I guess some of the key takeaways for those that might be listening and looking to sell is, like, a lot of buyers, especially in a certain price range, let's call it, you know, five figures and above, like, this isn't their first rodeo and they're handing over cash, right? So, you know, trying to bullshit your way through trying to sell a business is not going to work. And in fact, you're probably doing yourself a disservice because, you know, highlighting some of the key sort of strengths and some of the key weaknesses could actually open up an opportunity for someone like Mario who, you know, if there's a problem that they're facing that they haven't been able to solve, but Mario can solve it in, you know, 2 seconds, then that actually is a great opportunity for someone like Mario or whatnot. And then the second thing is just generally being organized with, you know, the data, and especially time and time again, financials seem to be the Achilles heels for most people. But, you know, having that organized, and, you know, if you're trying to do it yourself, like, that is a big job. You know, that is something that's definitely, you know, not an easy thing to do. But, you know, when you partner with the right people, and they know what buyers are looking for, then, you know, you can get that organized and leverage the expertise on that. But yeah, really, really good points that you brought up there. And, you know, I'm sure there's been plenty of other examples of category one that you've come across, but unfortunately you can't filter out those kind of players ultimately.
I mean, some specific categories that are very obvious and I can definitely call out, not necessarily names, but examples, is newer products alive for like 6 months or so. And then, you know, they've been around for 6 months and kind of flip a list them down as average monthly profit, let's say $1,000 a month, right? So they generated, in theory, $6,000 over the past 6 months, and it's just spread out, split up by 6 months. Essentially what they did is they launched something on Product Hub and AppSumo. They closed lifetime deals for $199 forever lifetime deal.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, closed, yeah, 40 of these, and then they generated a profit, and now, you know, they don't have a funnel, they don't have ongoing clients, and not only that, but you actually have to support that revenue forever if you pick up the business.
Sounds like another platform that I'm thinking of, but I won't name names. Yeah, anyway. But yeah, no, that's really good. I mean, it's just, I don't know, there's a bit of, like, ignorance, like, in terms of, like, actually, you know, what they need to do in terms of, like, selling a business. And generally, you know, human nature is going to be, like, you know, sharing everything that's positive and good and, like, trying to really sell the business, right? But, you know, exploring the weaknesses and bringing up some of the, you know, challenges within the business can be very, very beneficial.
I think also what you alluded to there, Mario, about businesses which are selling these lifetime deals, they need to be very careful. Because I think at the time when they're doing it, they don't think ahead, and they might think, okay, cash flow now is really good because I'm getting these lifetime signups, but this is actually future liabilities in the future for an exit, for someone that is going to buy the business in the future and these customers. So again, to reiterate, if you're a seller and you're thinking a shortcut way is to provide these great lifetime deals for your subscribers, actually you're shooting yourself in the foot. You know, while the short-term gain of the cash flow is really good, maybe for that month and that uptick in customer signups, within 3 or 4 months a buyer is going to see that straight away, and it's actually going to be a future liability against you. So I think that's a really good kind of point that you made earlier about these, you know, AppSumo, for example, or these other kind of, during your DD, you notice these things.
Yeah, and again, like, we come with good intentions first. So I'm pretty sure that everyone listening on the show who is potentially selling well intentioned, because they're not doing some shady stuff and they're
exactly
sellers. My point here is that buyers are facing a lot of these deals on the market, and that's what makes them extra careful, and that's what those tanking most deals. It's more about, you know, the good people should not be hurt or, you know, affected by what's happening out there from people who are not good intentioned. But if sellers are aware of whatever else exists on the market, it would help them craft a better offer or probably provide better transparency of where is revenue coming from and so forth. Again, like, Flippa provides lots of opportunities to take a look at, like, one clear example, the SEMrush integration. I love it. My agency, Devrix, is a SEMrush agency partner, so we run these reports anyways, but them integrating Flippa is amazing. And, you know, a business that claims to have organic growth and having a domain authority of 1 or 2 and 5 ranked keywords is obviously fake. It's just straight out of the door. Takes 2 seconds to figure this out. Or a business that's claiming to target the US audience, but then you see that organic traffic is coming from, I know, Afghanistan or whatever, right? Like, outside of North America. So you just see this and it clicks that something's off here. And again, some of these fake deals are easier to track down. The good news is that it's also easier to double check and kind of go through the checklist. And when you see a real deal, you see, okay, real website, domain authorities, 20, 30, whatever, check, looks like a real site. Keywords rank, 1500, okay, there's content on it, it's been ranking there for a while. Traffic seems organic, is fine, and so on and so on. So the good news is that when you come across a decent business, you know there are lots of shady deals, and it's easier to increase your chances by literally doing nothing, just because most buyers are aware of what's off and they just tick off boxes when they see that it isn't off for you, right? So it's more about not tanking the deal due to misunderstanding or lack of access or something else on your end.
Got it. Awesome. Well, like to wrap things up, like I want to sort of give you a bit of a, I guess, a promo or like a buyer mandate off the cuff here. So like, let's say, you know, right now you're looking for the perfect business that you want to acquire right now. Like what would that business look like, and what are you looking for at the moment? Because there might be someone listening that has this. So
that's great. To be fair, that's nothing in particular. It's more about I'm always open to great opportunities, but I'm going to list down several specific considerations that I have. One of them is the content sites that I mentioned. Something with recurring revenue from ads that hasn't died, at least $1,000 a month in ad profit, is something that is of interest. Like I can buy 10 of these and have, you know, 10K MRR from that portfolio of sites, and we can use it for other things. So this is one great example. Like if you have a content publishing website with decent content that's ranked on Google and has organic traffic from ads or, you know, subscriptions or show, anything that's relatable and is not going to churn away right away, that's great. So that's one category that I'm looking for. I'm also looking for small agencies. We're talking 2 or 3 people in strategic markets, North America, Australia, all sorts of digital, like creative, SEO, videography or show. So it's like small teams that, you know, they have the skills and stuff. They have a probably small portfolio, 2, 3, 4, 5 clients, but situated in a specific market, and they're willing to, like, we can use it to kind of exploit that market and just have presence there from day one instead of, you know, starting from scratch and building brand awareness and stuff. That's the second category. Number 3 is creative use cases with AI. I cannot just diminish AI because it's everywhere, but we see very interesting use cases of AI doing business plans or conversion rate optimization reviews or user experience reports and other automated stuff with a higher quality that we can just use as a lead generation funnel or so for existing clients, or just add it on top of our retainer lists and monthly reports and so forth. So these are kind of 3 pretty simple categories that I can think of, and there are others that I'm also looking for our clients and partners and others that are looking for small acquisitions or mid-sized acquisitions themselves.
Well, there you go, folks. That's really helpful. If you got a business like that, hit up Dom or Mario, preferably Dom first, so we can work through with Mario. But hey, we're agnostic here, so
we're here for education.
Reach out to Mario and Dominic. Hey, man, always be closing, right?
I was just going to say, Kristen, before you wrap up there, I also have one more question for Mario that we always ask our guests. Yeah. So every guest we have on the panel, Mario, I'm always curious, what is the most interesting book you've read recently or podcast you've listened to where you've got something out of it? It doesn't have to be business related, by the way. It could be mindfulness. It could be also fiction. I'm always curious to hear from our...
It's definitely not just one. I have a list of both books and podcasts. One that's probably relevant is the collection by Hormozi for $100 million offers and $100 million leads. Both books are pretty great, and I'm recommending that because, first off, they're packed with value, and second, for sellers, they actually need to build an offer for their listing. So they need to design and devise the right offer for the listing. So learning how to create the offer, which is essentially the formula for an offer, roughly speaking, is top value, like promises of the bright future, multiplied by odds to get there, meaning 99% chance this is going to happen, divided by friction and cost. So like if you make it affordable, incredible opportunities, 100% chance to get there, and almost frictionless, just transfer the keys and you get there, that's an outstanding offer. So this is kind of one example. Another one that I'm very passionate about podcast-wise is the B2B Revenue Vitals by Chris Walker from, well, he's running several companies actually. But it's really talking about the misconceptions in marketing nowadays, and it's definitely revealing in 2024 for how attribution fails, how the previous models of PPC aren't working very well, demand generation is going through restructuring, and so on. So if your playbooks aren't working right now and you still need to improve your EBITDA, go and listen in, and you're going to calibrate some things, improve your financial forecasts and models internally, and it's going to set you up for a better sale after.
That's absolute fire. I'm a big Alex Hormozi fan as well, and I never really sort of linked the two together of, like, you know, listings for sale actually having an offer within that, making it like easy, instant results, as little friction as possible, with the big promise that can be delivered on. That's absolute fire, Mario. Love it.
I honestly, I've seen listings just, you know, an autopilot business for you, you know, 1K a month recurring revenue. Again, autopilot could be ran for like 5 years, no need to touch it. Defensible business model, strong model. Like, as an example, right? If that turns out to be true and that's the starter of the listing, man, competition and bidding for that is going to be crazy.
I can see you sweating for it right now.
Literally.
Awesome. Well, look, it's great to have you on the show. Where can people connect with you if they want to sort of learn more about what you're up to, and what's the best way to see what you're doing?
Absolutely. Mario Peshev on LinkedIn is the best place to go. Just make sure you add to the comments that you've listened to the show, because I do ignore blank, non-personalized invites. Also, I'm on Twitter. Again, look up Mario Peshev, and my website, surprisingly, is mariopeshev.com. So feel free to pick any of the mediums, and more than happy to see you there.
Awesome, man. Well, thanks again, and look forward to connecting with you some point in the near future, man.